Now, today we have got as our subject, after the elections, a new era for Iran and the West, question mark. And I was saying to somebody a little earlier that it's extraordinary how, when you look at the whole of that region, you feel that things have completely sort of coagulated and nothing's moving in any direction. And then suddenly you look up and everything's flowing in all directions. And then suddenly it'll coagulate again, probably in another rather unsatisfactory coagulation. But we are, I think, at a moment of the coagulation disintegrating into flow, particularly in regard to Iran. And I thought, what better time to have this discussion. Our guests, and I'm going to introduce all three now, so that I will just call them after that. On my left, Sir Richard Dalton, who many of you know, Associate Fellow of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House and a consultant. He's a regular commentator on Iran, Libya and other Middle East issues. He was, in 2002, appointed ambassador to Iran, and he played a role in the European efforts to negotiate with Iran, including the 2003 to 2006 diplomatic initiatives to prevent the development of the Iranian military nuclear capability. So there is no one that I know of who is not more versed in the whole of this subject from every angle than he is. On my immediate right, I have Dina Esfandiari. She's a research associate who joined the Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Programme of the IISS in London in October 2009. Her research focused on non-proliferation and security in the Middle East, including Iran and Syria's WMD programmes. Prior to that, she worked at a disarmament NGO focusing on non-state actors. She's been published widely, and I look forward again to hearing what she has to say to us today. And finally, on my right, someone who really needs no introduction at all, the Right Honourable Lord Lamont of Lerwick, Norman Lamont, ex-Chancellor of the Exchequer, ex-Cabinet Minister, both under John Major and indeed under Margaret Thatcher. Again, someone who is a regular commentator on these issues, and again who has a very clear understanding of what is happening at the business end of our relations with Iran. He's chairman of the British Iranian Chamber of Commerce, and I'm going to ask him if he will start our proceedings today by speaking to us now.
Michael, thank you, and thank you to GSF for organising this meeting at such an opportune time. As Michael said, I first got involved in Iran through a business I was involved in, and I then became chairman, the unpaid chairman, I may add, of the British Chamber of Commerce. Just for the avoidance of any doubt, I'm not involved in any business doing business with Iran. And I've remained interested in Iran, really, because I got very interested in the politics through the business world, meeting Iranian officials and Iranian ministers. I began to develop a growing feeling that our perception of Iran was not exactly correct, and for that reason I have followed it quite closely over the years. Henry Kissinger a few years ago said that he wished that Iran would behave less like a cause and more like a state, and it's part of my argument that Iran has been developing in that direction, that the revolution is going to be put behind it. But, of course, Iranian politics has always been, right from the beginning, since 1979 in the revolution, a struggle between moderates and hardliners. Not many people know, for example, that this was true even at the time of the terrible U.S. hostage crisis, the embassy siege. The government of Iran were completely opposed to that. The entire cabinet resigned. Khomeini was against the embassy siege initially until he saw which way public opinion was going. And the embassy siege actually greatly increased the power of Khomeini. When President Khatami came to power, first in 1997 and then in 2001, one way of looking at his presidency was that it was the hardliners who prevented him, for example, not being able to stop the student protesters being badly treated, that his reform program was frustrated by the hardliners. That isn't, however, how Khatami himself sees it 100%. He also believes that he was given an inadequate response by the West and by the United States when he helped with the invasion of Afghanistan. He suspended uranium enrichment, and although there's some argument about this, put forward proposals for a grand bargain between the West and Iran, and for the normalization of diplomatic relations and the reining in of support for Hamas and Hezbollah. I do believe, after the Iranian elections, notwithstanding the positive things which I will say about Mr. Rouhani, obviously caution and skepticism are the right response, and sincerity is subject to proof. But I think we do have to be careful that we don't make the same mistake that we did with Hatemi. All Hatemi got for his pains when he tried quite hard to help the West and to improve relations was to be labelled the axis of evil. And Rouhani, from what we know about him, does seem to be a man very much in the tradition of President Hatemi. I find it very depressing that the moment Rouhani was elected, the propaganda machine went into operation. Of course, before the election, we were told the election wouldn't count, Rouhani wouldn't win. If he did win, he wouldn't be allowed to take office. And of course, when he did win, we were then told from mysterious sources that he had been involved in the bombing of a Jewish center in Buenos Aires in the 1990s, a claim that was immediately denied by the Argentinian prosecutors themselves. Like other people in this room, I followed the election day by day on the internet, and I was frankly astonished by the things that Rouhani said. His outspoken attack in one debate, as he put it, "Who are these plainclothes people who stop us in the street and ask us what we're doing?" His very first broadcast began with the words, "I am not a radical and I have never been a radical," and he blamed the radicals and their intransigence on the nuclear program for the problems that Iran had with the West. Just the other day he said, "You cannot judge a woman's virtue by her dress," a pretty outspoken comment in the context of Iranian politics normally. He praised the social media positioned himself as firmly in favor of freeing political prisoners and of freeing access to the media. Of course, one of the things that is said against Mr. Rouhani is that he is part of the system. Well, Mr. Gorbachev was part of the system, and we dealt with him. He believes in the system. Well, Mr. Gorbachev believed in communism and believed that communism could be humanized and made workable. I think Mr. Rouhani's position is no different from that of President Hatemi, who was much criticized for actually casting a vote in the elections for the Majlis. He was criticized by the reformers. But I think it was actually actions like that and the restraint of people like Rafsanjani, who even after his disqualification for the election did not protest in any way. And this made it easier for him to back Rouhani and for that backing of Rouhani to be accepted. To me, it is a plus point that Rouhani is part of the system. It's quite rightly said that he does not control all the levers of power. He does not control the Revolutionary Guards. He does not control the thugs of the Basij. He does not control the judiciary, which will make it difficult for him to honor his promises to try and release political prisoners. But he has held an astonishing variety of different positions within the very complex machinery of the Iranian government. He has been a member of the Assembly of Experts, which is a body of clerics that elects and monitors the supreme leader. He is a member of the Expediency Council that arbitrates in disputes between the Majlis and other parts of the Iranian government. He has been a Member of Parliament 4 or 5 times and Deputy Speaker as well. He's also been Secretary of the National Security Council, and he has been, in addition to that, the nuclear negotiator, and he was the nuclear negotiator last time when the decision was made to suspend uranium enrichment for 2 years. So I would argue that the fact he has been around the system so much is trusted by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, as well as being an ally of Rafsanjani and Khatami, means that he is in a strong position to persuade people to his line of thinking. Of course, people will say, but surely all power resides with the supreme leader, Mr. Khamenei. Well, we don't know precisely how strong Mr. Khamenei's position is within the regime. The fact that the election happened, the way it happened, the protests that were expressed through this astonishing election result with 26 million people voting is a fact of life which Khamenei himself cannot ignore. Mr. Khamenei's views are not a complete mystery. They're there for everyone to read on his own website. He's deeply distrustful of the United States and the West, believe we are out to undermine the Islamic system of government, but he has authorized bilateral talks with the United States, although he has made it clear at the same point that he believes they are doomed to fail, but he has authorized that such talks should take place. It seems to me that our relations with Iran are as bedeviled by history as those between Ireland and the rest of Britain. The Iranians remember our many interventions, the 1906 constitutional revolution that was thwarted by Britain and Russia, obviously the coup against Mossadegh, but above all the Iran-Iraq war and the shooting down of a civilian airliner by a United States warship in the Gulf with the loss of life of over 300 people. On the other hand, we in the West remember Iran's involvement with certain terrorist acts, and we also remember the terrible events of the embassy siege. I do think that in negotiations, it's not just about the nuclear. We have to have regard to Iran's own sense of insecurity, a sense that is highlighted and underlined really by the continuing assassination of their own scientists mysteriously in the street. Iran, although it has a large army, has a very feeble air force indeed. I saw that General Petraeus said not so long ago that the air force of the UAE could wipe out the entire Iranian air force in a very short period of time. And I think when we look at things like Iran's involvement with Hamas and its involvement with Hezbollah, we should see it in that context, less to do with theocracy and more to do with their own wish to have an asymmetric way of responding to any threat to themselves. I believe that a deal could have been done on the nuclear issue. I think the Turkish-Brazilian proposals that were put forward by President Ahmadinejad could have been accepted. But I do believe in the long run we will have to recognize Iran's right to enrich on its own soil, a right that is allowed under the NPT, a right that is allowed to many other countries. What I do not believe is that a strategy of just going on tightening and tightening the sanctions and producing more and more hardship in Iran will solve this issue or break the Gordian knot. I believe we must approach Iran cautiously and see what Mr. Rouhani is able to do in terms of delivering on his promises, but I think we have to be prepared firstly to look at their security needs and secondly to be a bit more flexible in our approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We've got one or two people standing in the back. Can I ask if one or two of the younger people at the sides here would mind standing, and then we can fit in some other people into the seats. Thank you very much. David, do you want to come? There's another. There's one or two more down here. No, don't everybody get up. However young you are. There's more room down here now. I'm now going to call on Dina Esfandiari to address us. Thank you. Whichever you feel more comfortable.
I'll be seated then, if that's okay. Thank you very much for inviting me along for this. I'm going to attempt to give you a quick overview of the elections, what happened, without any overlap, hopefully. A little bit on the internal politics and the way things work in Iran, and then tie all of that in with what I think or what I hope will happen with the nuclear negotiations, and all of that under the allocated 8 minutes. So, as you all know, the Iranian elections surprised many of us, certainly many of us Iran watchers. Politics in the lead up to the elections were very volatile. The first sign of a protest in October 2012, right around when the issues with the Rial first showed up. It was a very interesting event because riot police quickly came in, dispersed the crowds, and everything was taken care of, and calm was restored. And so many of us, Iran watchers, assumed that this was basically an indicator of how the elections would happen, proof that Iran would not tolerate any dissent. And in fact, in the months leading up to the elections, really security was very tight in Iran. In addition to that, Ahmadinejad's final year as president saw the worsening of internal disputes within Iran. The president was summoned to parliament twice in a year and a half, I believe. There were a number of public attacks, a number of back and forths between him, the Larijani brothers, and he really persisted in stirring trouble during his last year. This was likely intended to secure support amongst the masses as he lost support within the regime, and probably to keep to make sure that he was going to stay relevant after the elections, possibly to prepare his future candidate for the next round of the elections. Many of us thought that he wouldn't go that easily. I certainly thought he was going to cause a lot more trouble during the elections than he ended up doing. They were able to keep him quiet. In the months following up to the elections, the regime followed a dual-track approach, allowing many of the potential candidates to take meetings with Khamenei, for example, while stepping up their campaign of arrests and intimidation, and also arrests and intimidation of journalists and activists, as usual. The big question then became, would Khamenei allow a free enough election to help overcome some of the damage that had been done to the system with what happened in the 2009 elections and also Ahmadinejad's presidency? And would he do it at such a troublesome time? And on top of that, would he risk another 4 years of uncertainty? I genuinely thought that he wouldn't do that. So the elections were a surprise in that respect. In terms of the candidates, just a very quick overview, there were a very lackluster list of candidates that were approved by the Guardian Council, and Saeed Jalili emerged, the current nuclear negotiator, emerged as the front runner and Khamenei's chosen man. But he wasn't very popular, certainly not as popular as Tehran's mayor, Qalibaf, for example. But Rouhani ended up winning, as you know, and he emerged as the candidate that was a reformist by default. He, as you mentioned, he spent a lot of time criticizing the government, being very active in the debates, in his TV interviews. He was very blunt and uncompromising, which is unusual. And because of that, won the support of the reformists. Again, this to many of us it kind of meant that perhaps he wouldn't have a chance in winning, especially after a lot of his campaign officials were also intimidated and had to face a lot of trouble. But the regime instead decided to focus on ensuring legitimacy by boosting voter turnout. And so it seemed that they really were intent on repairing some of the damage done to the system by demonstrating that they were capable of holding elections. And on the day of the elections, in fact, they said that they had 80% turnout and were very keen to highlight this. I think the actual figure turned out to be closer to 72, but They also kept polls open late in order to accommodate the very last-minute surge of voters. Now, although it was a surprise, it really shouldn't have been a surprise. The last four elections have been a surprise, so this one was going to be the same. And on top of that, Iranian politics are characterized by their dynamism. They're not unified. They're not monolithic. There is a multiplicity of views that are actually represented. And although we often say control lies with Khamenei and he makes the final decisions, it isn't a one-man show. And no single entity makes decisions. It really is, you know, an interplay between the different factions and, of course, Khamenei. So the idea is actually to rule by consensus. This might help explain the long-term stability of the system despite the many setbacks and the many mistakes they've made along the road. The only downside is the regime doesn't have any long-term vision. Most of its policies are very reactionary. So an event will happen, and then they will make policy to address what has happened. They won't plan long-term. Now, a lot of people will argue, yes, but, you know, Iran has been planning for regional hegemony for you know, since the beginning of the Islamic Republic. Perhaps, but how they go about achieving that has never been a long-term plan. It's just been a reaction to various events in the region. So, with these elections, Iranians made clear their desire for change. It's very interesting to see how various Iran watchers have interpreted the results of these elections. Some see it as a victory for the sanctions regime. Well, we've put enough pressure on Iran, Iranians have had enough, and they've voted against the system. Others will see it as Khamenei's willingness to act leniently in the face of public pressure. And then others will state that this was always the plan. And as Lord Lamont said, Rouhani is part of the system. He passed the Guardian Council screening. He's a cleric with a long tradition of loyalty to the Islamic Republic. He didn't support the 2009 opposition. And he did support the clampdown on the student protests in the 90s. So it's a little bit hard to say. The other problem, of course, is that constitutionally, as was mentioned before, the Iranian president has very little power because Khamenei is still the ultimate decision-maker, although he's not the sole decision-maker. So two factors are important to consider. The first is Rouhani's willingness to change things, and the second is his ability to do anything. Khatami is a good example of that because it seemed that he was willing but unable because his hands were tied. So it remains to be seen what Rouhani's victory will actually mean for Iran. He's obviously responsible for the economy, which is a big topic within Iran. He may be able to influence the general mood and direction the country is taking, very similar to what Khatami did. He may even be able to loosen some of the restrictions on the daily lives of Iranians, again, as Khatami did. And his relationship with Khamenei and his position within the regime, as was mentioned before, might mean that he will be able to sway the supreme leader's views on some subjects. Certainly that's what's hoped. But so far he hasn't been clear on his plans for tackling the economy and tackling the economic problems. He has also indicated that he's not going to deviate from the current Iranian policy on regional issues, and Syria is a good example of that. Iran has invested far too much in its current policy in Syria, and it's the supreme leader in the IRGC that will decide what happens in Syria, or certainly what Iran will do in Syria. And Iran's existing foreign policy principles are really quite entrenched, but it's hoped that Rouhani might be able to impact them. So what does this mean for the nuclear talks? Well, a lot of us are hoping for more flexibility on the Iranian side and also on the Western side. It's interesting. I mean, some people are saying perhaps Rouhani's election is indicative of Khamenei's willingness to compromise. After all, if somebody like Jalili had been elected as president, it proved that Iran, you know, it would have proved that Iran was not willing to compromise because Jalili is a much bigger hardliner when it comes to the nuclear issue. So we'll have to wait and see firstly, what appointments Rouhani will make once he's president in August. But it is possible to be optimistic. In his press conference, in his first press conference, I believe it was, in mid-June, one of the first things that Rouhani did was to pledge greater transparency on Iran's nuclear program. He also said that, you know, Iran was seeking to reduce tensions and also sanctions. One of the main things that he said was, we will try to win back trust. But he is a supporter of the program. And like many within the regime, he sees it as a manifestation of Iran's technological achievement and national sovereignty. So the hope is that the talks will be more purposeful, they'll be more wholehearted. As was mentioned before, in October 2003, he was the one who allowed the partial suspension of Iran's enrichment program. And he did it in a very clever manner. He did it while continuing to brag to domestic audience that, you know, the suspension was a tactical ploy to enable the nuclear program to advance in other ways. And in fact, this was what he said in one of his television interviews in the run-up to the elections. But Iran is expecting a few things in the talks, and the question is whether the other side can deliver. The first thing it's expecting is reciprocity and weight in substance of a potential deal. So this means, in my view, one, sanctions relief, and two, as was mentioned before, some kind of acceptance of Iranian enrichment. Now, I would argue that actually enrichment is not a right under the NPT. The right to peaceful nuclear technologies is, which is a little bit different, and which I think is the wording that the West is playing on. But the point is, in Iran, this is far too big an issue now. The right to enrich has become a thing in its own, and so it is something that the other side is going to have to agree to. But the question is, will Iran be able to accept enough limits on its enrichment in order to prove the peacefulness of the program? Iran will also want an agreement on what they call the end goal. So not just the nuclear issue, but to basically talk about its larger strategic role in the region and have a clearer definition of its relations with the U.S. and Europe, for example. I would be slightly more optimistic than you are, and not use the word skepticism, but say that Rouhani's election, the election results, has led to cautious optimism instead of skepticism, and hopefully that will materialize.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm finally going to ask Richard Dalton to speak.
Thank you. Well, I agree with those who've spoken already that one election result does not make a new era. I've got six other things I'm going to say, and I'm going to run through them all and then dwell briefly on a couple of them, namely what these new opportunities may be, and secondly, what the European Union role might be. First, what we have now is an opportunity for addressing old difficulties. And the opportunity is not just in what Rouhani says, but it's also in how he says it. The fact that domestically he is a unifier, and that should concessions be required of Iran, and should Khamenei wish to authorize those concessions, he would not feel, in authorizing them, that he was empowering the politician who conducted them to be a threat to him. So many of us were commenting during the Ahmadinejad era that it would be highly unlikely that Khamenei would allow the deviant trend, as it came to be known, to take the accolades of significantly reducing tensions with the United States or even delivering an agreement. Secondly, we're still looking for decisive leadership on both sides of the nuclear controversy, one which on the side of the six countries rebalances the diplomatic and pressure tracks in favor of diplomacy, and on the Iranian side, one that rebalances the diplomacy and resistance track in favour of diplomacy. And frankly, up till now, we've not seen much in the way of decisive leadership. I think the realignment of political forces that we have seen in Iran, the fact that we are likely to get a government that spans principalists and reformists, concentrating on the centre to provide the intellectual and political weight behind Rouhani's government, but that makes the chance of decisive leadership more likely. But Dina is absolutely right to question whether the politics in the United States and Israel is yet moving in the right direction. And that will bring me my cue for what I have to say about the EU, because I think the EU has to take a public role in giving that politics of how to reach an agreement with Iran a shove. In the West, so far, we've seen policy dictated more by short-termism and a good deal of inflexibility and a good deal of woolly thinking, too. And we have to hope that those in the State Department and Foreign Office and in the Arsvetics and above all in Russia, who see the issues more clearly than that, can be given their openings by the politicians. And the best description of how to make use of those openings, and I'm going to give a plug here for a report issued in April or May this year by the Iran Project in the United States. I think it's entitled, I've got it here, Strategic Options for Iran, Balancing Pressure with Diplomacy. There's one report of the infinite number of reports that are out there that's accessible and doesn't concentrate on how we got here, but on what we should be doing now. That's the one that I would recommend to you. What they do is challenge the United States decision makers in that report, which has been endorsed by a whole series of luminaries of previous Democrat and Republican administrations, to challenge the prevailing view in the White House, which is one of ultra-caution and not giving the subject priority, to see that United States, Israeli, and GCC strategic interests would be best served by rebalancing in favour of diplomacy and ultimately in a deal. They say quite rightly, I think, that the objective should be a kind of grand bargain by stages. That's my phrase, not theirs, because the term grand bargain has got a very checkered history. But there's no escaping moving deliberately, but you do have to have the idea of a comprehensive approach in your mind as you take those preliminary steps. And above all, they challenge the US establishment to test diplomatic approaches in a way that has not been done hitherto. They've given a little and then rapidly pulled back too soon. For example, as Norman was saying over the Tehran research reactor. So what about the new opportunities? Well, clearly, with sanctions, we have got Iran's attention. Everywhere I think that I've observed sanctions working, there are, broadly speaking, two effects. One is defiance, we're damned if we're going to be pushed around. And the other is, we're in a hole, it's getting deeper, how do we get out of it? And it seems from the mood around the election campaign that that second reaction is undoubtedly the dominant one, not just amongst ordinary Iranians who made their economic concerns so evident, but also within wide sectors of the security establishment generally in Iran. Of course, although we can say that Rouhani is a unifier and the Supreme Leader sees him as a safe pair of hands, we don't know how hard his political opponents will fight. It's been well recognized in Iran that you can surrender to the West, or you can defy the West, or you can occupy that middle ground. And at times, the middle ground has been supported by a consensus, maneuvering, they call it, within the Iranian establishment. And I think that can be re-establish that consensus that Iran's job now is not to defy but to manoeuvre. But how hard will the IRGC, who are thought to have had in their hands the military elements of the past Iranian research and development programs which were terminated in 2003, how hard will they, for example, fight? In the next round, which I think is going to take place this autumn, I mean, the six countries haven't met, they don't know what to do, just as the Iranians don't know yet how on earth they're going to reconcile the domestic imperatives of improving the economy with the international dimension without which they cannot improve the economy. So there's something of a blank slate on both sides. The position of the six up till now is that a perfectly good offer was made and Iran should simply pick it up. Now, it's possible that Rouhani would advocate that. My own view is that the six should supplement that offer by offering a firm agenda which can show Iran that there either will be straight away or without any way of avoiding it, a proper discussion about the right to enrich and the lifting of sanctions progressively. The ones that are really hurting are the oil and financial sanctions. And the view amongst the six now appears to be, this is before any discussion of strategy among the six, that oil and financial sanctions couldn't be exchanged for the kind of confidence-building measure dealing with the 20% enriched uranium worry that people have at an opening stage. And at some point, the Iranians are going to test that and say, well, maybe we won't give you a confidence-building measure of the kind you want unless you give us something on that. Well, we don't know which way that discussion is going to go. I mean, there are certain lessons that can be drawn from previous rounds of this diplomatic dance. And one is, don't let the best solution that you wish for be the enemy of a good solution that you could actually live with and which would meet many of your objectives. Clearly, neither side has succeeded in its achieving its objectives over the last 10 years. The West is facing a more dangerous Iranian nuclear program, potentially, although there is no decision as yet in Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. And Iran is further away from respect, security, and prosperity, which is the ultimate guarantor of the survival of the Islamic regime. So, provided people won't camp on their extreme positions, then there's a chance that we can make something of this next round. The EU role, I think the EU should try and use its powers more creatively. It's just tucked in the last few years, quietly behind a British, German and French lead. And that hasn't exactly delivered much, has it? So, personally, I think there ought to be a profound debate within the EU. Whether there will be or not, I don't know. The instinct of the three that sit on that group of six, Britain, France and Germany, will be to try and avoid such a discussion until they've fixed what they want and then deliver it to the EU. But my thought for our own legislators present in the room is not to let that happen and to be in touch with like-minded people elsewhere in Europe to say that the wider debate in Europe about its interests, which are not the same as Israel's and the United States' interests, should come first and should inform any strategy making by the ministers of the six powers, which is probably likely to take place in New York around the General Assembly week. And I think in general, the EU role can be one of pathfinder, a new dialogue. It fizzled in 2005, the one that lasted more or less a decade under Ahmadinejad. His negative view on our human rights dialogue, for example. A new kind of dialogue should be offered to Iran as one of the encouragements to Rouhani. I think we should be saying, provided there is an agreement on confidence-building measures, then such a dialogue appropriate for this decade would be launched. And finally, if people were to agree that a more assertive EU role in line with EU interests should be developed, and it does need to be promoted publicly. The strategy of just whispering quietly in the State Department's
here will be revealed by the eventual Chilcot report to be utterly and totally useless, and we shouldn't fall into the same mistake over Iran. Thank you.
Thank you very much.